books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm Robert Kirkwood, and today I have a long chat with the American journalist, art critic, and novelist of works such as The Intimacies, Katie Kitamura, about her latest book, Audition. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library. Audition by Katie Kitamura is described as an exhilarating, destabilising novel that asks whether we ever really know the people we love. The audio version of Audition is read by Tracy Kato Kiriyama.
It seemed an unlikely choice, this large establishment in the financial district. So then I stood outside and checked the address, the name of the restaurant. I wondered if I had made a mistake. But then I saw him through the window, seated at a table toward the back of the dining room. I stared through the layers of glass and reflection, the frame of my own face. Something uncoiled in my stomach, slow and languorous, and I decided it would be better if I left now and did not go into him. At that moment, the front door opened and a man stepped out. He inclined his head and held the door open, and because of that small courtesy, an invitation or injunction to enter, I went inside. The foyer was busy with diners collecting their coats, people surging in and then out of the entryway, and briefly I allowed myself to be buffeted by their movement. When the crowd dispersed, I could see across the dining room floor again. He was bent over the menu, examining it in a nervous posture. His table was between the entrance to the kitchen and the bathrooms, caught in a stream of constant traffic. A pair of businessmen bumped against its edge, and he sat back impatiently. I saw him take a deep breath, as if trying to collect or steady his thoughts.
Audition is about a woman who is very much in the middle of her life. She's an actress. She is happily married. And her life is upended when a stranger comes to her and tells her that he believes he is her son.
And I believe it was a headline that gave you the idea for the book.
It was. I saw a headline that read, "A stranger told me he was my son." And I actually didn't click on the link because even just from those handful of words, I already knew that there was a novel in that premise for me somewhere. But I couldn't quite work my way beyond the premise and into the actual world of the novel. And so for quite a long time, I set the idea aside and I wrote another book. Then I was going for a walk with a friend who's a poet and whose son is quite a bit older than my own children, who's now in his mid-20s. And I recited the headline to her and she just looked at me and said, "But that's just a description of parenthood. Every time my son comes home from university, it's like a stranger has walked into the apartment." And at that moment, I really had a sense of the book that I wanted to write, which is about the contradictions and the incommensurability that's very much at the heart of some of our most universal experiences, whether those are of parenthood or of marriage or of making art.
It's not just older children. I think from baby to toddler, they become a different person almost every couple of weeks. There's always something new.
I think that's very true. You know, before I had children, I think I wrote quite a lot about the instability within interpersonal relationships in the context of marriage or, you know, romantic relationships. And I was very preoccupied with this moment when you look at a person who you think you know very, very well, and then they appear to you like a stranger. And then, of course, once I had children, I realized that that is extraordinarily turbocharged with children. As you said, they are changing rapidly, even between the ages of kind of birth and 5, 6 years old. You know, there's the emergence of language, of personality. Their own sense of you also changes very profoundly. I think you become a different person for them. I remember the first time my children realized that my name wasn't actually Mommy, that I had a name out in the world and that to the world I was somebody other than who I was to them. It's a really mutable and fascinating relationship.
The host asked if I had a reservation. I said that I was meeting someone and indicated the young man seated at the back of the restaurant. Xavier. It occurred to me that the host must have been the person to seat him at this inhospitable table, and I saw a flicker of surprise cross his features as I pointed. He looked quickly from my face to my coat to my jewelry. It was my age, above all. That was the thing that confounded him. He gave a tight smile and asked me to please follow him. I was under no obligation to obey. I could tell the host that I had made a mistake, or that something had come up. I could turn and slip away. But by that point, it seemed too late. And much as I had entered at the behest of the man at the door, according to the imperative of mere courtesy, I followed the host through the warren of tables, each one occupied. I wondered again why Xavier had chosen such a crowded venue at such a busy time, when we might just as easily have met elsewhere, in the afternoon, in the morning or early evening, for a coffee or quiet drink.
Let's talk about the structure of the book. There are two distinct halves that split almost bang on in the middle. How did you come up with that structure?
I mean, I think there's a couple of reasons why I use that structure. One is that I had the sense very much as a writer that I had not fully employed all the possibilities of structure in my work. And I was interested to see if structure could do some of the work that we conventionally associate with plot. So can structure create the sense of momentum that carries a reader through to the end of the book? Can structure create an effect that is not dissimilar to that of a plot twist, for example? Those are some of the things I think I was formally or theoretically interested in when I was thinking about the structure. But really, I think it was the sense that I could either write about this sense of incommensurability, this sense that there are things that are irreconcilable in our lives, that we can be strangers both to others and to ourselves. I could either write about it or I could write it directly into the form of the book, and I opted for the latter.
Now, we won't go into spoiler territory, but there are problems with the book's memory. Is that a reflection of something about your character? I'm trying not to use the word dementia, but there is a sort of reality shift in the book. Was there the thought that the memory of the character isn't what it should be?
I love this phrase, reality shift. So one of the things I really wanted to do in this book was to write something that was very open to interpretation. I wanted the book to be read in several different ways. And I would often describe it as a rabbit duck drawing of a book. So if you look at it from one angle, you see a rabbit. And if you look at it from another angle, you see a duck. And in the middle of the book is a story about an actor who has dementia. And while he is beginning to lose his memory, he turns in a performance that is really very, very extraordinary. And the central character, the narrator, is very moved by this performance. And then she is told that, in fact, the actor has dementia. And she's trying to understand if that changes the nature of the performance. And I think ultimately she decides that the performance itself exists, and that performance exists in the space between the actor and the viewer, in the kind of space of interpretation that is really made by the viewer as much as it is made by the intentions of the actor. And I think I wanted that to be a little bit of a guide to how I was thinking about writing the book, which is that to some extent, I think my intentions felt, I wanted to separate the text a little bit from what my own intentions as an author were. I don't think I have any more authority over the text than, say, the reader does. But what I will say is that when I was getting the kind of first set of impressions back from various people at my publisher, quite a few people felt that the central character had dementia in some form or another. And that was the reason for, as you described, this reality shift. And that is certainly one of the intended ways for the novel to be read.
Do you know the book by Ali Smith called How to Be Both?
I know of the book and I have not read the book, which is terrible. I'm a big fan of Ali Smith. I don't know how it is that I haven't read that one.
How to Be Both is two stories that talk to each other, but the book was published in such a way that half the copies had one story at the beginning and half the copies had the other story at the beginning. So the reader never knew in what order they were going to get the stories. Is that sort of like Audition, where we could read the second half first and then consume the first half?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I was talking to a wonderful writer, Caleb Azuma-Nelson, who said that he read the novel through as it is printed, and then the second time he read the novel through, he started at the beginning of the second half and then read the first half as the second half. I really wanted to write a book that felt like a circle, that it could loop back to the front of itself in some way, like a Möbius strip in a way. There's also a wonderful book that was published this year by the American writer Catherine Lacey, which sounds not dissimilar structurally to the Ellie Smith novel in terms of how it was produced, because if you could start on either side of the book, it's kind of on one side it flips over. I'm not explaining it very well, but it's upside down, so you can read either half as it's really impossible to tell which is the actual front of the book, and it produces a similar effect where you're not quite sure where the beginning is and which half is the start. I mean, I think mine probably has a more concrete beginning, middle, and end, but I really like the idea that you wouldn't be able to prioritize which half of the book was the so-called reality and which half of the book was a maybe fantasy world or a construction.
The din pressed against me, crowding the inside of my head so that it was hard to think, difficult to locate my thoughts amidst the noise. Xavier looked up as we approached. He set the menu down and rose to his feet. I remembered that he was unusually tall. I was momentarily intimidated, whether by him or by the situation, I wasn't sure. He smiled and said that he hadn't been sure if I would come. He had been on the verge of giving up hope when at last he had seen me. The host had already disappeared. We sat, one on either side of the table, me with my back to the wall. I looked across at Xavier and slowly unwound the scarf from my neck. He was still smiling. From the start, I had noted his natural charm, his charisma. But I now saw that he dispensed it with too free a hand. He didn't seem to understand the intensity of its effect, or the fact that he moved through a world inhabited by other people. In this sense especially, he was still very young. I put the scarf down and apologized and told him that I was usually on time. He shook his head, manner too eager. He said that there was no need to apologize. It was only because he was anxious. It was only because he'd been afraid that I would change my mind that he'd had such thoughts. Under ordinary circumstances, a 5-minute delay would pass unnoticed. He was himself often late.
And we'll hear more from Katie after we take a visit to the RNIB Library to find some new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. If You Only Knew by Lulu was donated by Hodder.
I was born Marie, and I will die Lulu. This book is about the journey between those two people. Losing parts of myself, finding others and all the many shapes I've bent myself into over the 60 years in the music business. Because I've always tried to be honest, but haven't been completely open. The reason? I grew up in a home filled with secrets before being catapulted into fame at just 15, with no idea of who I even was. And so I became whoever I thought people wanted me to be. Bright, bubbly, always smiling. That face has been on your TV and radio for years. It's who I am in some ways, of course. I'm definitely positive, and I've certainly been around for decades. But the image of me created when I was young was as one-dimensional as a single ray of light is compared to its infinite refractions. Still a child in so many ways, I took on the part created for me and played it so well, I gradually lost who I was. I became the version of myself I thought people wanted me to be. Not just in public, but personally too. And I paid a price for molding myself into so many shapes and forms until life, as it often does, forced me to take a long, hard look and finally answer the question, who am I?
Pop legend Lulu looks back over her astonishing life with fresh eyes, reflecting on all she has learned. From the tenements of Glasgow to the Royal Albert Hall and the glittering lights of Hollywood, Lulu's journey to fame and fortune is like no other British pop star. When she was 14 years old, she was invited down to London to sing, and the rest is history. She stepped into a part she played for the next 60 years, a part she played so well that she gradually lost who she was, becoming the version of herself she thought others wanted to see. It is the story of one woman's determination to stay real, relevant, and happy, and one which ultimately reveals a woman who's far stronger and far braver than anyone knew.
I was glad I borrowed my mum's leather jacket. Otherwise, I might have shivered and I didn't want to look scared. In front of me, a row of men sat behind a huge sound desk, cigarette smoke curling into the air as they chatted. "Ready to go?" a voice asked. It was summer 1963, and the Glen Eagles boys were standing with me in a Decca studio. Jimmy on rhythm guitar, Ross the lead guitarist, Dave our drummer, bassist Tommy, and Alex, also a vocalist. We'd been performing together for a couple of years in clubs, but never anywhere like this. There have been so many people, places, and performances since then, but even though I was just 14, I'd already been performing my whole life. We'd been brought to London after winning a competition in the Scottish Daily Express to find the next big thing. The prize was an audition with Ron Richards, a producer at EMI, home of the Beatles. But although he'd turned us down, he'd sent us on to see Dick Rowe at Decca. The Rolling Stones were signed there, so it didn't feel like too much of a knockback. Now, as I stood waiting, I forced myself to shrink once more into that safe, deep place inside me, where only my voice mattered. I wasn't quite sure what I was supposed to do, who I was supposed to be, but I knew how to sing. Pulling down the mic, I glanced at the Glen Eagles boys for a final time before staring ahead. "Ready, Marie?" a voice asked. I nodded. I took a deep breath. We'd done this track hundreds of times before. I just had to relax and hit the first notes, right? That was the key. Breathing deeply, I looked up and let the first long, vibrating, almost angry note pour out of me, the sound cascading into the mic. Powerful. Raw.
If Only You Knew is written and read by Lulu and runs for 8 hours and 14 minutes.
The Silver Book by Olivia Lang was donated by Penguin Random House.
He's walking back from the Tate, pictures in his head, enjoying the looseness of the afternoon. There's a delicious sense of autumn in the air, like hitting a cool patch when swimming. He jogs across Horsefree Road, ducking between buses and jumping onto the pavement. There's a hoarding outside the newsagent. He must have caught the photograph out of the corner of his eye, snapping back to see the headline. The rush of nausea is so intense, he doubles up. This is not what he intended, not how he thought things would go. He forces himself upright. He has to exert all his self-control to walk casually down Tufton Street, to turn the key in the double door, to enter the lift. No one sees him. He needs to get out of here for a start. He needs to erase his traces, to vacate the premises before somebody comes. He looks around the room, the mirror room he has always hated. There is almost nothing of his here. In the bedroom, he bundles his clothes into a bag, finds the neat stack of 20s in the bureau, takes them all. He leaves his books. There's no name in the flyleaves. Better not to weigh himself down. He will have to leave London. That's the first thing. Or should he leave England altogether? Remove himself from possible questions, speculation. It started to rain, fat spots puckering on the glass. He runs through the logistics, get the ferry train to Paris, all of Europe available from there. His thoughts swim away from him, back to the photograph of Alan's soft, sober face. This time he digs his nails into his thumb until the dizziness has passed. He finds his Mac, turns the pockets out onto the bed. Passport, handkerchief, sketchbook, pencil. His own tooth marks fill him with disgust. It is the 17th of September, 1974. He is 22, and he has already obliterated the first of his lives.
It is September 1974. Two men meet by chance in Venice. One is a young English artist in panicked flight from London. The other is Danilo Donati, the magician of Italian cinema, the designer responsible for realizing the spectacular visions of Fellini and Pasolini. Donati is in Venice to produce sketches for Fellini's Casanova. A young and beautiful apprentice is just what he needs. He sweeps Nicholas to Rome, into the looking-glass world of Cinecittà, the studio where Casanova's Venice will be ingeniously assembled. Then, in the spring, the lovers move together to the set of Salo, Pasolini's horrifying fable of fascism. But Nicholas has a secret, and in this world of constant illusion, his real nature passes unseen.
He has buttoned his coat. He has locked the door. For a minute, the key confuses him. He walks quickly to the river. It's raining for real now. Good. People keep their heads down in the rain. He stands on the embankment and allows the key to slip from his hand into the river below. Imagines it falling through the churning currents, fetching up alongside Roman coins and pins, never to be seen again. Not that anything is that secure. Then he turns for the station. City men with rumbling stomachs, bound for Hampshire or Sussex, the concourse a sea of wet tan Macintoshes and bowler hats. In a different mood, he could get into a different kind of trouble here. He's sweating. He goes down the stairs to the urinals, walks into a stall and blots under his arms with a shiny wad of tissue. In the mirror, his face is paper white, carrot-topped. "Buck up, Gerald," he hears a man say, and an answering laugh. He meets his own gaze and consciously flicks the switch, makes himself alluring, wide-eyed, then turns himself off. He's a good ghost, practiced at the art of invisibility, the knack of becoming an object that eyes skim over. Sometimes it's useful, though increasingly he wonders what would happen if he forgot the reverse, the jump into legibility that returns him to the world.
The Silver Book by Olivia Lang is narrated by Ben Cura and runs for 5 hours and 30 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
And now a return to my chat with Katie Kizamura. The audio version of Audition is read by Tracy Kato Kiriyama.
There was an awkward pause, and then we both spoke at once. I asked how his classes were, and he apologized for how he had behaved the last time we met. "I understand how I must have sounded," he said. "You must have wondered if I had lost my mind, if you had reason to worry." His words drowned out my question, the shore of ordinary conversation rapidly receding. He had spoken over me, not out of any chauvinism, I didn't think, but out of an excess of enthusiasm or nerves. He spoke like a person who did not have time to waste. I looked at the menu and said that we should order. I wanted to eat, and I wanted to have a drink, as soon as possible. He paused, then ducked his head down to examine the menu again. I asked if he already knew what he wanted, and he said he wasn't especially hungry. "I have no appetite," is what he said. Still, when the waiter arrived, he asked for a hamburger and French fries, the order of a child. Despite myself, I smiled.
In the RNIB library, we also have intimacies, and a separation is also available out there in audio. Do you think addition shares some DNA with your last two books?
I do. I really think of the three books as being in conversation with each other. They are all unnamed female narrators. They're all characters who exist somehow in a sort of in-between state. They're all characters who are very much involved in the work of interpretation in one form or another. In A Separation, the central character is a translator. In Intimacies, the central character is a simultaneous interpreter at a war crimes tribunal. And in Audition, the central character is an actor. And then they're all characters who speak the words of other people. They are not the authors of their own speech in some way. And so I was interested in thinking about questions of passivity and agency. I think we're a culture that places a lot of emphasis on agency, but very often my feeling is that what we actually have in our society and our culture is not so much agency as the illusion of agency. So these are characters who I think understand that and who are interested in understanding the terms of their own passivity.
There's also a crossover in that Intimacies and Addition also have a shared narrator in Tracy Kato Kiriyama. Were you responsible initially for her casting as the audio narrator of your book?
I was. As you know, as a writer, you're sent maybe three or four samples of narrators reading maybe the first five pages of the book. And I really loved her delivery. And the audiobook producer also strongly recommended her for Intimacies. And then when it came to Audition, I'd had so much positive feedback from people of her interpretation of Intimacies that I just said to the audiobook producer, "I don't think we need to get samples. Let's just go ahead and see if Tracy is available." And she was, which was really wonderful. And for this book, you know, I think audiobook narrators, they're really interpreting the text, as you know. It's really a collaboration between the writer and the narrator. And this time, I think because it was the second book, she reached out to me and we had a conversation about how she was interpreting the book, how she should be rendering certain sections of it. And it was a really wonderful and very meaningful interaction for me.
I ordered my food and then asked the waiter to bring me a vodka tonic. It was past noon, and I saw no reason not to start drinking. As soon as the waiter left, I looked at Xavier and asked again how his classes were. I was determined to put things on a more neutral footing, but in doing so, I seemed to antagonize him. I could see that he took this dispassion as an affront. He was silent, and then said in a sullen voice that his classes were fine. "Fine," he said, and nothing further. I pressed on. I asked who his professors were. It was possible I knew some of them. But he shook his head and said that he was mostly taking technical classes this semester, and that I was unlikely to know his instructors. Still, I persisted. "I'm interested to know what you are learning," I said. "What kind of work you want to make? Who you admire?" "I admire Murata," he said after a sly pause. "I love his work."
Now, I've heard you give readings from the book. Was it ever in the conversation that you should narrate one of your books?
No, it's never been. I've never been asked. My husband is also a novelist, and he's narrated, I think, the last two of his books. And he's a very, very good narrator. I think it's very physically and psychologically demanding in a way to do these audiobooks, but certainly very physically demanding. I remember he recorded one of them during the pandemic, and it was because it was a pandemic, he recorded it from home, and it was many, many hours of reading. The only time I recorded something for an audiobook was for the German writer Annabel Hirsch, did a book that's called A History of Women in 100 Objects, and she had 100 different women read out one of the sections. So I did that for her book, which was a pleasure. But I've never done the audiobook for my own work.
How many pastries did you get through in the writing of this book?
Many. I mean, my terrible secret is that I'm a very bad eater of breakfast. I usually skip breakfast. I kind of have the caffeine hit of the coffee on an empty stomach. But the one breakfast that I do find myself eating is pastries. And so pastries are kind of a recurring motif in the book. I think because it's fun to write about the things that give you pleasure, even if they feel a little bit like inside secrets.
So they would give us pleasure, but your character seems sort of trapped with them.
They are. So in the book, there are a handful of physical objects that appear in both halves of the book. The pastries are the main one, but there's also a scarf that appears in the first half and also in the second half. And it was important to me that they would appear in slightly different guises. And so the pastries have this almost oppressive, I don't know, slightly surreal quality to them, and it becomes increasingly menacing. If a plate of pastries could be menacing, there's always too many of them. They seem to be spending a fortune on baked goods. So that was also fun to write.
The book could easily have tipped into horror. Were you thinking about horror when you were writing it?
Absolutely. I mean, all three of my last books I've thought about in relation to a genre of some kind. For A Separation, I was really thinking about missing persons or murder mysteries. For Intimacies, I was thinking about courtroom dramas. And for this novel, I was thinking very much about horror. The one of the novels that was a reference point for me, both the novel and the film, was Rosemary's Baby, which is another story about troubled parenthood and New York real estate, which are two themes in Audition as well. So I really wanted to play around with that feeling of uncanniness and unease. And I think with the best horror, obviously, the thing that is frightening is never from the outside. It's always from the inside. The call is always coming from inside the house. And that's very much true in the novel. The thing that is the most frightening is actually for the central character. There's a moment when she suddenly stops and she realizes that, I think she says something like, I was the problem. I'm the problem that everybody is maneuvering around. And so I think horror is really interesting because it seems initially that the incursion, the threat is coming from the outside, but always in very well-structured horror movies, it's always something that's coming much deeper. It's often something that has to do with the history of either the characters or the place that they're in, and this sense that, time becomes very strange and gummy in horror films and horror stories. That was something I wanted to play with, and certainly something that inspired me a great deal in the writing of this book.
Were you playing around with gender as well? Because we've seen the story, You Are My Father, many times, but we don't often see the story starting with, You Are My Mother.
Yeah, absolutely. My novel, A Separation, was very similar in that I felt looking around that there are so many stories that begin with the body of a dead woman. And that's almost the starting point for the narrative. Who she is really of very little interest. So I thought to myself that I would write a novel that was centered on the body of a dead man instead. And in this novel, it was exactly that. I think this question of patrimony is so well explored in our culture. The idea of, you might be my father. I think you're my father is a narrative we're very familiar with. But flipping it and calling into question the identity of a female character felt interesting to me. I think in part because there's almost this assumption that there's something static about the identity of a mother, of motherhood, but in fact, the experience of it is so volatile in so many ways. And I think that's something that we're exploring more and more in our culture. But I definitely, absolutely was interested in seeing what happened if I just inverted it. And In terms of writing, it's very simple inversions, very simple decisions often open up a lot of space within a novel, and it's interesting to see what that allows for.
The title audition, who's auditioning who?
I think that all the characters are auditioning each other on some level, but in the most fundamental sense, I think they are auditioning themselves and trying to understand what part they wish to play in their own lives.
You say part you want to play, a performance is a big part of this, and to a certain extent, it truly is all the world's a stage and we're all playing a part.
It's so funny because for the entire time I was writing the novel, the title was Performance, and I was very interested in the way performance is central to the construction of identity. And in terms of how performance allows for a certain amount of code switching, I think the central character is somebody who knows how to be as people want her to be in different contexts. And it's interesting to think about performance and character and identity because I think there tends to be an almost negative association with that idea, with the idea that you might be performing a part. But, when you look at small children, when they're four, five, six, they're all do a great deal of play acting. They play the part of being a mother or a teacher or a bus driver or whatever it might be. And we are told that that is how young children learn to be in the world. And in fact, the doctors will usually tell you that if your child is not doing that, that it might be a matter for some concern. And it's fascinating to me that that kind of role play, which is seen as so central in children and that we can see even in their behavior all the way up through adolescence, it's as if once you reach adulthood, that time is over and your identity is fixed and you no longer have need for performance in order to be in the world. But I think there's no reason to think that would be the case. I think, in fact, we are constantly relying on performance in order to be. When I first became a mother, there was no natural and immediate understanding of what that meant. Instead, I was very aware that I was drawing from what the culture was telling me about what motherhood looked like, what maternal behavior looked like. And in some ways, it's actually, to me, much better to be aware of that rather than to be unaware of it, because it allows you to change the terms of the identity that you're forming. But yeah, I do think performance is an element of how we are, whether we want it to be or not, and whether we're aware of it or not.
At what point did the name change from performance to audition?
Very late, I want to say. After the copy edits were done, certainly. It was maybe around the first pass page, what they call the first pass pages, when you're just kind of going over the proofs and making sure there aren't very many errors. And I think you're told you can only change a certain amount of the text without incurring a fee from your publisher. It was at about that stage, I think, that suddenly both my editors in the US and in the UK said, we're not actually sure this is the right title for the book. And I think they wanted a title, which I agree with, that felt a little bit less passive, that felt a little bit more active, that felt like there were questions at stake in the novel. So, we worked together and they helped me arrive on the new title.
The waiter arrived with our food, and as he hovered above us, Xavier reluctantly slid his hands from the table and into his lap. The waiter began setting our plates down, his gaze moving surreptitiously from me to the young man and back again. I raised my head and his gaze skittered away. Xavier began to eat. As I watched him, the movement of his mouth as he chewed, his sinuous throat, I felt an unexpected charge between us. Although he was a stranger to me, in so many respects unfathomable, I knew the details of the fantasy he had created, the castle he had built in his mind. He had shared its private architecture with me, and that disclosure was a form of intimacy.
Now, through the magic of editing, the listener will have heard Tracy's reading of Audition. Now that it's out there in audio, it's accessible to people for whatever reason, sight loss, dyslexia, don't have a relationship with the printed word. Is that important to you?
It's very important to me. It's very, very important to me. And I think the question of accessibility, in particular with books, is central. I think about libraries, for example, and public libraries in particular. And I I try to understand why I find them so deeply moving. And I think it's because they're founded on this very simple but quite radical principle that which is that information and knowledge should be made freely available to all. And accessibility is at the heart of that. And that is becoming, I think, more and more difficult, certainly in the United States. And so it's something that I feel as a writer, of course, very passionately, or not so much in terms of wanting my work to be read and widely consumed by many people, but more in the idea that it really should be one of the founding principles of our society.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book in audio form or the Braille version is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of Audition?
Yeah, it's a very simple text-based cover. It's a black backdrop with the words audition and my name, Katie Kitamura, written in block letter script. And each letter is marked by horizontal fractures and a kind of multicolored motif with these very vibrant shades of green and orange and pink. And then beneath that is, in gray cursive script, a novel by the author of Intimacies.
The waiter cleared his throat and asked if there was anything else he could bring us, anything we needed. Xavier had eaten a third of his hamburger while the waiter was arranging the side plates and garnishes. He swallowed and took a long drink of water. The waiter's face, with its careful neutrality, was like a mask. As I stared at him, I suddenly recalled an incident many years ago, when I was not even 20, in a restaurant much like this one, but in Paris. I had met my father there, and he had taken me to lunch. I was then a thin scrap of a drama school student, and in his general worry about me, he ordered a vast succession of dishes. Once the waiter had gone, he told me he had something special that he wished to give me, something he and my mother had seen in a shop in Rome. I opened the box with a gasp of delight. It was an emerald necklace, beautiful and extravagant. And once he fastened it around my neck, I embraced him. I had not realized until that moment how much I missed the regular company of my parents. Perhaps my reactions were in some ways secondhand or performed, the gasp of delight, for example, but the feeling they were designed to express was sincere. I have that necklace still, and I think of my parents whenever I wear it. But I also think of something else, another version or interpretation of the scene that took place between my father and me at that restaurant in Paris. And while it did not contaminate my memory of that lunch, one of the last before my father died, it did represent to me the definitive end of my girlhood and the start of the long stretch of what is called womanhood, the end of which was only now in turn beginning to approach.
Audition is available in print, in audio, and as an ebook commercially. It's also available in Braille and audio from RNIB Talking Books. Anki, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert.
And we'll have more from Katie with Books of My Life after this.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. What happens in the Talking Book Studios when the narrator makes a mistake?
What the engineer used to have to do is stop the tape, wind the tape back a little bit, listen to a place where we could slot the reader back in again, tell the reader where we wanted him to start, play the tape, and at the same time as putting a cue light on, we used to put the player into record, therefore rubbing out the mistake and recording the whole thing correctly. So what we're left with is a tape which was 2 hours long, one side of tape was 2 hours, without any mistakes whatsoever. Most speech studios would come along and edit all the books afterwards, but in the way we did it, we were able to say right at the end of the book, that's it, we haven't got any more work to do, and it was a perfect finish.
And I've been reading for RNIB, blah, blah. How's that? Does that work?
The new digital Bokingtuk?
Bokingtuk, yeah. It's Bokingtuk. A new word.
I enjoyed doing this sort of thing for its own sake. And if
Damn. Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, Braille, along with many other benefits such as Braille music scores, online forums, and much more.
Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's show, a return to Katie Kitamura, author of Addition for the Books of Our Life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
The book that made me fall in love with reading was The Three Musketeers. I had been given a very beautiful, hardbacked, illustrated edition, very, very lavish, for a birthday. I think I must have been in second or third grade. I was quite young. My parents are both immigrants to the United States. And one of the great benefits of that is that they did not have a sense of what books were appropriate for what age. So in fact, The Three Musketeers is probably too difficult to give to a second grader, but they had no idea. They just gave the book to me. And I read it, and it was challenging, but incredibly exciting. And I had a real sense of achievement when I finished reading the book. And I think that sense of a new world opening up, that sense of excitement, but also definitely that sense of achievement, was enough to get me really hooked as a reader.
It's a big book.
It's a big book for a second grader.
On the first Monday of the month of April 1625, the village of Meung, where the author of The Romance of the Rose was born, seemed to be in as total an upheaval as if the Huguenots had come to make a second La Rochelle. Many of the townsmen, seeing women fleeing along the main street, hearing children crying on the doorsills, hastened to put on their breastplates and, backing up their somewhat uncertain countenances with a musket or a partisan, headed for the Jolly Miller Inn, before which jostled a compact group, noisy, full of curiosity, and growing every minute. At that time, panics were frequent, and few days passed without one town or another recording some such event in its archives. There were lords who fought among themselves, there was the king who made war on the cardinal, there was the Spaniard who made war on the king. Then, besides these hidden or public, secret or open wars, there were also the robbers, the beggars, the Huguenots, the wolves and the lackeys who made war on everybody. The townsfolk always took up arms against the robbers, against the wolves, against the lackeys, often against the lords and the Huguenots, and sometimes against the king, but never against the cardinal or the Spaniard. The result of this acquired habit, thus, was that on the first Monday of the month of April 1625, the townsmen, hearing noise and seeing neither the yellow and red standard nor the livery of the Duc de Richelieu, rushed for the Jolly Miller Inn. Arrived there, each of them could see and identify the cause of the stir. A young man, let us draw his portrait with a single stroke of the pen. Picture to yourself Don Quixote at 18. Don Quixote husked, without hauberk and greaves. Don Quixote dressed in a woolen doublet, whose blue colour was transformed into an elusive nuance of wine lees and celestial azure. A long, brown face, prominent cheekbones, a token of shrewdness, enormously developed jaw muscles, an infallible sign by which to recognise a Gascon, even without a beret. And our young man was wearing a beret, decorated with a sort of feather. Eyes open and intelligent, nose hooked but finely drawn, too tall for an adolescent, too small for a grown man, and whom an inexperienced eye would have taken for a farmer's son on a journey, were it not for his long sword, hung from a leather baldric, which slapped against its owner's calves when he was on foot and against the bristling hide of his mount when he was on horseback.
That's Paterson Joseph reading from The Three Musketeers by Alexander Dumas, one of many versions available from RNIB Talking Books. Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
I love Ford Madox Ford's The Good Soldier, and that's a book I probably read once, if not quite once a year, maybe once every 2 years. I think it's a really extraordinary novel. The structure of the novel is so cunning. It looks completely natural and organic. In fact, it's so beautifully and carefully and meticulously structured. And I always intend to start out reading it. I start out reading it thinking I'll figure out how he's done it. And then I just get swept up in the prose and the story, and I forget about it altogether. And I close the book, and each time I think I have no idea how he did that.
This is the saddest story I have ever heard. We had known the Ashburnhams for 9 seasons of the town of Nauheim with an extreme intimacy, or rather, with an acquaintanceship as loose and easy and yet as close as a good glove's with your hand. My wife and I knew Captain and Mrs. Ashburnham as well as it was possible to know anybody, and yet in another sense we knew nothing at all about them. This is, I believe, a state of things only possible with English people, of whom, till today, when I sit down to puzzle out what I know of this sad affair, I knew nothing whatever. 6 months ago I had never been to England, and certainly I had never sounded the depths of an English heart. I had known the Shallows. I don't mean to say that we were not acquainted with many English people. Living as we perforce lived in Europe, and being as we perforce were leisured Americans, which is as much as to say that we were un-American, we were thrown very much into the society of the nicer English. Paris, you see, was our home. Somewhere between Nice and Bordighera provided yearly winter quarters for us, and Nauheim always received us from July to September. You will gather from this statement that one of us had, as the saying is, a heart, and from the statement that my wife is dead, that she was the sufferer. Captain Ashburnham also had a heart, but whereas a yearly month or so at Nauheim tuned him up to exactly the right pitch for the rest of the 12-month, the 2 months or so were only just enough to keep poor Florence alive from year to year. The reason for his heart was approximately polo, or too much hard sportsmanship in his youth. The reason for poor Florence's broken years was a storm at sea upon our first crossing to Europe, and the immediate reasons for our imprisonment in that continent were doctor's orders. They said that even the short channel crossing might well kill the poor thing.
The Good Soldier, A Tale of Passion by Ford Marrocks Ford, is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library as read by Peter Wickham. Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
I fairly recently read Muriel Spark's The Driver's Seat, which is a little bit like The Good Soldier, just a book. You think, how did she do this? It really grabbed me by the throat from the first page, and I really felt like I couldn't breathe the entire time I was reading it. It's such an extraordinary book. It's a little miracle of a novel. And it's interesting. I read Muriel Spark much younger. I think I read The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie and The Girls of Slender Means, which are kind of the ones that I think most people start with. And obviously, you know, there's a real acidity to those books, but it goes so much deeper in the other books. And so it's really been a pleasure to go back and read the entirety of her extraordinary body of work and see what incredible range and consistency she had as a writer. But the one of all the books that I've been rereading of hers, The Driver's Seat, I think really took my breath away.
And the material doesn't stain, the sales girl says. Doesn't stain? It's the new fabric, the sales girl says. Specially treated, won't mark. If you spill like a bit of ice cream or a drop of coffee like down the front of this dress, it won't hold the stain. The customer, a young woman, is suddenly tearing at the fastener at the neck, pulling at the zip of the dress. She is saying, "Get this thing off me at once!" The sales girl shouts at the customer, who up to now has been delighted with the bright coloured dress. It is patterned with green and purple squares on a white background, with blue spots within the green squares, cyclamen spots within the purple. This dress has not been a successful line. Other dresses in the new stainless fabric have sold, but this, of which 3 others, identical but for sizes, hang in the back storeroom, awaiting the drastic reductions of next week's sale, has been too vivid for most customers' taste. But the customer, who now steps speedily out of it, throwing it on the floor with the utmost irritation, had almost smiled with satisfaction when she had tried it on. She had said, "That's my dress." The salesgirl had said it needed taking up at the hem. "All right," the customer had said, "but I need it for tomorrow." "We can't do it before Friday, I'm sorry," the salesgirl had said. "Oh, I'll do it myself then," the customer had said, and turned round to admire it sideways in the long mirror. "It's a good fit. Lovely colours," she said. "And it doesn't stain," the salesgirl had said, with her eye wandering to another unstainable and equally unsaleable summer dress, which evidently she hoped now to offer the satisfied customer. "Doesn't stain?" The customer has flung the dress aside. The salesgirl shouts, as if to assist her explanation. "Specially treated fabric. If you spill like a drop of sherry, you just wipe it off. Look, miss, you're tearing the neck." "Do you think I spill things on my clothes?" the customer shrieks. "Do I look as if I don't eat properly?" "Miss, I only remarked on the fabric that when you tell me you're going abroad for your vacation, there's always the marks that you pick up on your journey. Don't treat our clothes like that, if you please. Miss, I only said stain-resisting, and then you carry on after you liked it." "Who asked you for a stain-resisting dress?" the customer shouts, getting quickly, with absolute purpose, into her own blouse and skirt. "You liked the colours, didn't you?" shouts the girl. "What difference does it make so it resists stains if you like the fabrics before you knew?" The customer picks up her bag and goes to the door almost at a run, while two other salesgirls and two other customers gasp and gape. At the door she turns to look back and says, with a look of satisfaction at her own dominance over the situation, with an undoubtable excuse, "I won't be insulted."
That's Caroline Lynn reading from The Driver's Seat, one of many of Muriel Spark's books available from RNIB. And once again, Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 450 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.